We're going to be looking at Esther chapter 5 this morning. My anticipation is to let this book go a little quicker from this point on, due to the fact that it becomes a lot of narrative from here on in, and yet within that narrative is some amazing theology. And so we're going to try to combine some of the narrative with the good theology and not beat this too much, I guess the way I should put it. Although we could spend a lot more time, and I just know that some of the stuff is repeating. We're going to see, I believe, this morning in our message, the overarching meta-narrative, if you will. The main lesson for us in Esther is going to become really prominent, I believe, this morning. And once again, you'll just see it kind of reiterated in the smaller chapters as we're going to. Although, kids, if you like action-packed blood, guts, and gore type movies, not saying you should, but if you do, the rest of Esther is going to feed that for you as you see it. Would you stand with me, please, as we read God's Word, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 5 in Esther. This is what we read. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters. While the king was sitting on his throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly so that he may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. As they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." And Haman went out that day, joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him. And now he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I'm invited by her, together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast." This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. May the Lord add his blessing to the reading of his word, and you may be seated. You know, a good suspense movie always leaves you waiting for the sequel. You know, they write them that way anymore. They just don't have those set movies where just you can sit for an hour and a half and just watch it and be done with it and saying, "That was good. I like that." But you just got to wait for the next one to come out. Or good TV shows, okay, from one week to the next. Those of you that are Doctor Who fans will understand that you know, there was always, he's left right at the very end of that show and doesn't quite know whether he's going to survive it, whether the aliens are going to eat him or whatever. You got to watch Doc Who and understand that. But it's always one suspense week to the next. You're not quite sure how it's going to turn out, whether the heroes are going to survive or not. And that's basically what we see in chapter 4 at the very end. There was a cliffhanger here, if you remember last week's lesson. It starts off this week, it starts off a little bit differently. It takes right where this was 3 days later, where the chapter 4 left off, this cliffhanger. There's no assurance based in the end of chapter 4 that things are going to work out well for Esther. These were no empty threats that if you come before a king, a Persian king, if you come before him, even as his wife, the queen, and you have not been summoned, the law is you will be put to death. But there is an exception can be granted. And that exception will be if you find favor in the king for whatever reason, he holds out the golden scepter to you, you will live. But the law is you will be put to death. And so there is no empty threat here that she could just kind of saunter in as she wanted to and come and go from his study to see what he's up to. No, that didn't occur during the Persian king era. As a matter of fact, many of the historical carvings and historical pictures, if you will, the depictions, I guess they would be, of Persian kings actually have the king sitting on the throne with his royal guard around him and the court around him. And one of the courtmen is always an axe man, literally carrying an axe. And you know what that's for? It's not killing chickens, okay, for the supper that night. The axeman was to kill people who had come into his presence not being summoned. And so this is no idle threat here. This is where we left Esther last week in chapter 4. But chapter 5 begins to take us out of the suspense a little bit, like a new week movie being shown, new week's rendition of it. And it says this in verse 1. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Notice what Esther has done. She has put on her royal robes. Now, I don't think many times when I read scriptures, I know that I sometimes am accused of overanalyzing things and saying, well, you have to look at that particular word or those couple words. I believe it's very particular that she put on her royal robes. Because the last time you remember that she went into the king was during her adulterous audition to get the job as queen. And we don't know what she took in. She was only allowed to take whatever she wanted to take. She wanted to take one item, and we're not sure what that item was that she took in. But here she does something completely different. She wears her royal robes. And I think that you see this morning as it expands that this is part of her plan. She went in there, though, and I believe wholeheartedly, based upon the Hebrew writings of chapter 4, that she went in with the anticipation as that if I die, I die. It was a resignation to what she considered to be the inevitable. I haven't been into the king for 30 days, if you remember last week's lesson. 30 days I haven't been into him. He hasn't summoned me. And so if I just appear there, I'm probably going to die. It was a resignation in her mind. And so I think that when she walks in at this particular moment in her royal robes, she really is resigned to the fact that I'm probably not going to be granted favor. I'm probably going to lose my head by that guy over in the corner with that sharp object. That's probably what's going to happen. But instantly, we're left off the hook. The suspense is left off the hook because this threat is removed from Esther. At least for the time being, it has been removed from Esther. Because we now see part one of her plan has worked. She's able to walk into his presence, granted favor. She can now at least approach him to speak to him. But when I say that it was done in part, that it was relieved, her threat of death was relieved, the Jewish community in general, though, still has hanging over their head the death edict. It's coming, less than a year. The edict handed out by Haman in the king's writing, with his signet ring already on it, law of the land, which cannot be changed, is already in place. So there is a death sentence upon the entire Jewish community. Guess who's a Jew? Esther is a Jew. And so at least temporarily, this threat against her has been removed, but it hasn't been removed completely. And so now we see Esther, and I'm going to say this, that her savvy and her subtlety is going to play out very well. She has to have that law changed. Somehow, She is going to have this law changed, and she's going to need all the savvy, all the planning, and all the subtlety that she can. Next part of my message, I entitle it different passages so I have an idea where I'm going. I said, playing it well, Esther, playing it well. That's what I see from here on in with Esther. This is why I believe that we see the heroine. If there is a story of Esther as a heroine in this entire book, we begin to see this more and more. See the change coming. We see this turning point. The king obviously had to know that something extremely important is on Esther's mind. I mean, think about it. She's here. And she knows the law. And so the king instantly knows that there must be something pretty important for her to take this chance. But the difficulty of the situation doesn't allow Esther simply to blurt out what it is. I got through part one. I'm allowed to at least go in. So why don't I, in my way up to the throne, blurt out the fact that my people are going to die and the only way for us to save is for you to change that law somehow. Why doesn't do that? Why doesn't she just blurt it out? I believe that you're even going to see hesitation in the way this is actually worded here. She understands the enormity of this request that she's making. She is appearing unsummoned to the king. The potential of death is there. Something extremely important is bothering her. But yet, is it amazing what the king actually says to Queen Esther? By the way, noticed he calls her Queen Esther. No longer from this point on in the story, you're going to see her referred to as Queen Esther. Up to this particular point, it has just been Esther. But there's beginning a change in the heart of the king, even, granting favor to her at this moment and calling her Queen Esther. And instantly, what's your request? I know you have something. You wouldn't appear here for no other reason. What's your request? I'll give it to you. I'm going to fulfill whatever that is, up to half of my kingdom. But there's a challenge for Esther. It's an irreversible law that she is trying to have reversed. That's the law of the Persians. A law is a law, can't be reversed. So she, in essence, is looking at an impossible task and trying to have this law reversed. It was a law that was sponsored by the most powerful man in the country next to the king. Haman, nobody's more powerful. He is second in command of this nation. And so it's sponsored by him. It's in his handwriting. It's in the signet ring of the king also. And what's it going to cost? Remember, Haman's already said, I'm going to pay you. If you follow through with killing all of the Jews, I will pay you half of the tax revenue that you're going to get this year. Haman's a very wealthy man. And so this is going to cost the kingdom an amazing amount of money also. How's this guy, this king, and we know that he's big on saving face, right? Remember the whole thing that started with the story of, oh, my wife didn't listen to me, you know, we got to get rid of Vashti somehow. He's always interested in saving face. If he acquiesces, and this is going through Esther's mind, if he acquiesces to what I'm asking, how possibly is he going to save face? And lastly, I believe probably one of the most important things going through her mind, for 5 years now, I've been lying to the king. I got to tell him who I am. I'm a Jew. I have intentionally kept that secret from him. How's he going to respond knowing that his wife has lied to him for 5 years? Nothing short of a miracle is going to give her a favorable answer. She's had 3 days of fasting, if you remember at the end of chapter 4, and I believe now we begin to see the implicit calling out to God, not the explicit. That was part of last week's message, just why I believe that one of the lessons that we can learn, we can't simply sit by at times and just implicitly call out to God, but there's times that we must explicitly call out. But for purposes of the writer, the way they've written it, I believe that implicitly we can see that Esther not only has been fasting, but she has been crying out for God's favor, for divine intervention. It's interesting, she has absolutely no position to expect favor from God, does she? There's been no dramatic signs. There's been no thunder and lightning from heaven. There's been no direct voice. There's no hand coming out of the wall, writing on the wall of a particular message as in times past that has occurred. There's been nothing dramatic. And so what happens here? Esther understands that without all of that, she needs to have some type of strategy. Now, don't get me wrong. You're going to see as this message unfolds. Some of you may say, we just rest upon God. Let go, let God. I'll deal with that statement in a little bit. But we have to have a specific strategy. Esther understood that. If the king's heart is going to be opened up and God is going to work within that heart, there needs to be a strategic plan on Esther's part, and she understands that. So she chooses to postpone the request and simply invite King and Haman to a feast that day. And Esther said in verse 4, "And if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for him." And he kindly accepts it. Something's on her heart. Something's on her mind. Got to be more than simply a feast, but hey, food and wine, I'm turning that down, he says. And so you read verse 5. Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. Once again, they're at the feast now. And what does the king say to her? Verse 6, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What's your wish? It shall be granted you. And what's your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." He once again is beginning to recognize the great risk that Esther has taken upon her life. It has to be important. There has to be something major going on with Esther at this point. And so if there's a time, at this particular time, two times he's committed himself, if she is primed to be able to blurt out her request to him, you would think. And I believe that she almost begins to answer him. Because if you look at the little semicolon in some of your wording, look how verse 7 starts. "Then Esther answered, 'My wish and my request is,'" and it stops. So there's a hesitation in the writing here. And so there's almost a sense that Esther realizes, I'm just going to do it. Now's the time. I mean, he's twice now said this. He's happy. He's probably drunk. So now's the time to get him to, I mean, that's what he seems to work on. He gets liquored up all the time and he makes these stupid edicts. All right, maybe my opportunity is now. She hesitates there. Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is." There's a hesitation in it. She breaks it off. And she once again says to him in verse 8, "I got another feast for you to come to. If I have found favor," and I love the way she says this again. Instead of blurting this out, she once again says, "If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I'll prepare for them. And tomorrow I will do as the king has said." Why didn't she strike again? Why was it the iron's hot? Why doesn't she just strike right that particular time? Because I believe she is working a strategy as best as she possibly knows. The king now twice has announced, "Whatever you want, whatever it is that's on your heart, whatever the request is, I will grant it to you." The king, in essence, has bound himself. Think about it. He has bound himself publicly by his word to grant whatever is upon her heart, at least twice now. But I believe Esther is a quick study. I believe she knew this to begin with, how she got the job. But I believe she has an innate way of understanding people and personalities and natures of people. And I believe that she appeals to the greatest element, if you will, the greatest attraction that men have to women. Now stay with me on this. It's meekness. If you think, women, that men are attracted to bold women, there are a few of them out there. But generally, men are attracted to the meekness and the gentleness of women. And I believe that's exactly what she says here. Listen to it. "If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king." The king is in full control. Here's a meek woman in front of me. Here's a meek, gentle person. You're going to see Paul talk about that as to how to win unsaved husbands later on in the New Testament. And we see that being played out in the king. Now, there's a sense that he likes that control. But you go back to the book of Genesis, isn't that exactly part of what the curse is all about? There's a hierarchy been placed out, and one of the curses, women, upon you, according to what Eve was given, was your desire to control your husband. And she knows that. And she has turned that completely around, and she's extremely meek before him. If I have found favor in the king's sight, and if it pleases the king, basically saying, this is up to you. This is completely up to you. The king now basically signs his own confirmation, obliging himself to whatever this request is going to be. She is walking him almost down that path. As Jeff has done with cross-examinations I've seen many times. I actually was going to try to work this in, but I thought it better not because I'll probably speak too much about things. But a good attorney will walk somebody down the path they want to whenever it comes to witnesses on a stand. One question leads to another question, leads to another question, and now you are there. You can't answer truthfully any other way other than what it's been set up. And that's what we see here. This king is now confirmed that he is going to have to grant this request. If you show up, king, I will do exactly what you said, and you have said that you will grant it. So, king, if you show up tomorrow, you were pretty much confirmed you're going to grant my request. And the whole time, the king thinks he is in absolute control of this. If I have gained favor in your sight, if it pleases the king, just come to the banquet tomorrow and I'll make my request known to you. She's done everything in her power that she can. She's laid her plans out very well. She's come up with a strategy after implicitly crying out to God for divine intervention. I believe she has been able to devise this plan. Now look at Haman. This is amazing story. If I could have preached just on Haman, just spent a couple of weeks, I probably would have here. This is an amazing picture of human nature to us. He leaves in the highest of spirits, doesn't he? Not only is he high on the spirits of wine, but he leaves there in great spirits emotionally, high in prestige. Tell me Esther doesn't know him. Know what drives this guy. Exactly. This is exactly what drives this guy, this high in prestige. He craves above all things, not simply significance, not simply power, but to be acknowledged of that power. That's what drives Haman. Well, he's powerful. He likes that. But what really drives him is the significance that's known by other people, as long as people talk about him, as long as people bow down to him. It's an amazing honor, he thinks. Think about it, the king and me alone with the queen. I mean, it was nobody else was invited to this party. It was just us, nobody else, the prestige that went along with this. Popularity is his goal. And every time that he sustains that popularity, he's in a good mood. If his idol, and that's what I call it, and I want us to see important scriptures talk about idols in the Old Testament. The idol of his heart is to be seen as significant. Not simply to be significant, but to be seen as significant. And I'm telling you, if that ego, if that idol isn't being stroked, then instantly his mood can change. Because what happens? He's on the highest of high as he leaves the king's palace. The highest of high. Just me alone was with the queen and the king. And there's Mordecai. Ooh. He staggers a little bit. He has to catch his breath. Everybody else in the court now then bows down as like they're supposed to. And guess what Mordecai does? Sits at his desk, if there is such a thing. Not moving at all. I will not bow down to the enemy of God. And he knows it. And instantly, look at verse 9. And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. You know the people. I'm on top of the world. And while you're still talking to them, I'm at the pits. You go from here to here in Mach 2. There's nothing even within the personality. That's what we see here. Everything is driving him because his significance is absolutely at its peak. And then he walks out and he sees Mordecai not bowing down to him. And he is filled with wrath against Mordecai. Haman's failure to instill any type of fear or respect in Mordecai instantly set him off. It instantly turned his joy into anger. Nothing's changed. Seriously, has anything changed from one moment to the next in this story? Is Haman still the second most powerful person on the face of the earth at that time? Just because Mordecai doesn't bow down? Is his power diminished in any way? No. Was his power even increased because he went into the queen's party as only one of two people? Was somehow he given more power and more prestige because of it? No, he wasn't given it. Circumstances didn't change. And yet he goes from elation to amazing wrath. And the situation hasn't changed at all. Haman is incensed. His emotional strings were being pulled by the idol that sits on his heart. Scripture is replete about that in the Old Testament, about the idols that we set up on our own hearts. See how that plays out this morning. The idol upon his heart is public respect. Not so much the power, but the idol that sits upon his heart was public respect. When that idol was fed, things are good. When it's being stroked, things are going real well. When that idol gets challenged, though, great anger follows. What has Haman's anger already given way to? Back a couple of chapters. He was angry with Mordecai, and that same anger led him to make and devise up a plan that was going to kill and to exterminate every one of these Jews. It's the same anger. His joy and his anger are simply outward expressions of the idol that sat on his heart. And I hope you're listening to what I'm saying this morning, because this message talked to me all week, and you're going to see why. You're going to see how. Outward expressions are simply evidences and identifying idols that sit upon our heart if we're not careful. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself. He didn't walk over and punch him out. He didn't do it off with his head. He knows that's coming in less than a year. But yet he restrains himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. So once again, what's he going to do when he goes home? What do you think he's going to do? Seek godly counsel? Call his pastor up and see, well, what should I respond? I'm a little upset with Mordecai. No. He calls his friends, he calls his wife together, and he is there to boost his ego again. It's his ego, it's the idol that's upon his heart, and he is going to boost it even more so. And Haman, listen to this, he calls his wife and his friends in, and now he's just going to reiterate to them his accomplishments. Look at me, look what I won, look what I did, look who I am, so you can buff me up again because Mordecai didn't. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants. His wealth, his sons, his promotions, all these things that all his friends knew. Do you honestly believe that his wife needs to be reminded how many sons he has? Nobody needs to remind the wife how many sons they have. The wife has not forgotten this at this particular point. And then he saves the best news for all to buff his ego. Verse 12. Then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow, also, I'm invited by her together with the king." Haman alone, the king alone. Ain't I something? Look at me. I mean, none of you were invited, were you? I know, wifey, you should have been there, but you weren't. Okay, that's exactly what he's saying here. He's buffing his own ego up. And I'm going to go again tomorrow. But it's of no consolation because Mordecai didn't bow down to me. Pathetic. How pathetic is this? I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread. But Mordecai didn't bow down to me. Highs and lows. Listen to verse 13. Yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. It doesn't mean anything because of that one Jew. That one Jew will not bow down. So none of this means anything to me. So here's a case study for us on the human nature and how to counsel biblically. How to counsel ourselves biblically. Even though I believe that we can probably assume that Haman is not one of the children of God, as we Christians actually are. I think we can make a safe assumption here on that. And so we can say he's an unbeliever, he's ungodly, not of the covenant people, probably in hell. Okay? I think we can make those assumptions here from this. But nevertheless, we can still, as Christians, have the same idols of the heart that Haman had. Simply because you and I become Christians doesn't take the seeds of the sins that lie within our heart prior, take those away. We have a new heart, we have new power, we have new promises, we now have a victor already over those things, but the seeds are not removed. And so those idols can absolutely exist upon even the Christian's heart. And we can respond in the same manner. So I do believe that it's time well spent for us to be able to take a look at Haman's response and the advice that he was given from a biblical perspective. CCEF, where the ladies are, the seven ladies that went from the church at their national conference right now, we use a ton of their material here. It's called Christian Counseling and Education Foundation. One of the core classes that they have is How People Change and Helping People Change, the two courses. And one of it, within that very first course on how people change, they have a model of how biblical change actually occurs. That model is repeated many, many, many times throughout the scriptures. Those of you that have been at Midweek Refresh know what I'm talking about. That model that they talk about of how biblical change actually comes about is demonstrated to us in a picture, and that picture is of heat, thorns, the cross, and fruit. That is the model of how change actually comes about. The heat of life is going to produce some type of a response in people's lives. Without Christ, that response is thorns. But with the cross and with Christ, that same heat doesn't have to produce thorns, but now can produce fruit. That's the model that we have within Scripture. And I believe that's exactly what we see here. We see the heat of this life producing in Haman amazing thorns. And I believe those thorns can also be played out in Christians' lives if we aren't careful, depending upon the idol that Christians have placed upon their own hearts. Haman made public recognition. Public recognition is his idol. That's what he's done. He lived it. He breathed it. Lest we as Christians think that we may not fall prey to it, be very careful about that. Pats on the back, public recognition can easily for Christians become an idol of their heart. As long as Haman was receiving adulation for whatever he was done, things were great. However, when he wasn't receiving it, he responds every time, lashing out in anger. Even though he seems the same power before, no power change has occurred whatsoever. Something is going on. There is an idol that is sitting on his life. There is an idol that is sitting upon the throne of his life. There's a void, if you will, in the center of his life. To some degree, even though he is not the most sympathetic character in the story, Haman, okay, this is the guy you like to hate. Every good story has one of those people, and you have it in Haman. But at the same time, I think we need to step back and have a little bit of sympathy for him, a little bit of empathy, okay, for what the guy is going through. There's a sense in which he's crying out for somebody to help step into the very midst of his life with his friends and with his wife to be able to call them together. Somebody needed to be able to stand up and really tell Haman what he's really crying out for. He's looking for some guidance. He's looking for some direction, I believe, when he calls them all together. Why else? Why not just simply wallow in your own pity at that particular moment? But I think that he really is calling out, like most counselees that I deal with, same thing. They're looking for some direction. They're looking for some instruction. They're looking for some biblical advice. How do I get over these overpowering negative emotions that are going on in my life? What's wise biblical counsel? A situation that I'm telling you that we can each identify with 2,000 years, well, probably 3,000, 3,500 years later. We can identify with the struggles that go on within our own lives and in our own hearts. Or, guaranteed, you will sit down across the table from a struggling brother or sister with some issue upon their heart. And so what do we say to them? Well, we need counsel. I believe that what we could have done and what we should have done, if we looked at it from a biblical perspective with Haman, was we need to begin asking questions as, Haman, what's driving your life here? I want you to think about this. Okay, several hours ago, you were on cloud nine. Nothing could go wrong in life. Everything was coming up roses. I mean, everything. You had it all by the tail. And just moments later, an amazing outrage from you. What is it that's driving your life? We use the opportunities. In Haman's case, we would use the opportunity to take a look at the rage, take that opportunity to be able to evaluate his life. What is it that's driving you? How can you help a person discern their heart? And I'm here to tell you, how can you look at the same things in your own life to discern your own heart? I'm going to see how that plays out. What gave you overwhelming joy, Haman? What gives you overwhelming joy today? What gives me overwhelming joy today? Overwhelming joy. And at the same time, what are the events that trigger rage in you today? What events trigger rage in me today? You see, we've heard it said that there is a God-shaped void in our lives. I was trying to find out who actually said that. I think every Christian pastor and counselor probably has said it, but who gets credit for it? A guy by the name of Blaise Pascal in the 1600s. He was a mathematician, a Christian, amazing, brilliant man. Actually came up with the whole idea of some equations within triangles at age 12 and that still dumbfound us today. Amazingly brilliant guy. And he made the statement that he's credited with, that there is a God-shaped void that's within each person. And he didn't actually say that. He said something close to it, and I want you to read this to you this morning. He wrote this in 1632. And I want you to listen to it, because this is all of us. This is all of us. There is, in essence, a God-shaped void that only God is going to be able to fit into. And what do we try to do? We set another idol into that void. We try to set something else, and sometimes it's shaped just like you. Sometimes it's shaped just like me. I become the own idol of my heart. It's about me and me alone. But listen to what Blaise says. What else does this craving and this helplessness proclaim but that there was once in a man a true happiness, of which all that now remains is the empty print and trace? This he tries in vain to fill with everything around him, seeking in things that are not there the help he cannot find in those that are, though none can help, since this infinite abyss can be filled only with an infinite and immutable object, in other words, by God himself. Isn't it amazing to think about as creations? That you and I were created internally with one particular purpose, and that was to bring glory and honor to God the Creator. And that still exists thousands of years later in every human being actually born. That's what he was talking about, is this void that's missing. And we know it, and we have an amazing craving to fill it at all times. We know that there's a greater purpose. We know that there's something better out there. We know that there's always pushing forward for whatever that is. And what do we try to do? We try to fill it with anything other than God himself. That's what Pascal was saying, and that's exactly what we have with Haman. And so if we're asking Haman, Haman, what is it that you're trying to fill in your life that can only be filled by God? What is it? He wouldn't have to go too far in his past. You don't have to do that age regression thing. You know, let's talk about your father and your mother. You know, how they treat you when you're three and whatever. No, you don't need to go back that far, Haman. We just go back a few hours in your past, and we can come up with it. If Haman would have only recognized the idolatry that was in his life, just shown how the events of the day challenged this idol upon his heart, he could have been redirected, if you will, to God himself to understand that it is the gospel itself that will bring you true significance. If you want significance, Haman, you will find it in the person and the finished work of Jesus Christ, the only significance for which you were created for. He could have been introduced to the God who doesn't simply judge us by our prestige, doesn't judge us by who we are. Fortunately, he doesn't judge us because of who we are. He doesn't simply look down and say, there's enough good there. There's enough good in this one. I'm going to say something about a recent commercial I heard on one of the Christian radio stations, and I won't. But if you hear something saying, if you're good enough for God, you're good enough for us, find a country station for 5 minutes and then go back, okay? Because you'll hear it, all right? But no, you are never good enough for God. Never. God loves you because he loved you. That was free. Anyways, I don't know why I even said that, but he could have been introduced to God at this particular point, that who loves people regardless of who they are and what they have done. I don't care how significant you are, God says, because you're not significant without me. I only give you the significance. They could have been taken. His personal achievements don't mean anything in front of God. We don't gain more favor in front of God because we do good things for him. Unfortunately, Haman didn't receive biblical counsel. He was running into his friends. What's their counsel? Their counsel? You go for it, buddy. You feed it. You feed the idolatry in your life. Look at verse 14. Then his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. 75 feet tall. Okay? By the way, it's not a gallows from the Old West. I think I might have said this in my first message. Sometimes we have to understand a little bit different. The gallows wasn't simply to hang somebody by the neck until dead, you know, like the Old West did. A gallows was really nothing more than a pointy stick of which you impaled the person on and held them up. That's what a gallows was during these particular times. 75 feet. I can do it with an 8-foot one. Okay, I could do it really. If you're going to kill somebody, you're going to pale them on a stick. You can do it probably a lot less than 8 foot. But if you want to hold them up a little bit so people can see, you can do it on an 8-foot one. Now, you make this one 75 feet tall more, or Haman. And then you have him impaled upon that. That will buff your ego. That will bring it down to size. This will really what you're looking for. You want to deal with the idolatry of your own heart? Then we stop feeding it. Haman's perspective should have been the idolatry within his heart. It should have been killing the idolatry instead of feeding it. And this is exactly the opposite of what his friends did. His friends step into this and say, you feed it. You go for it, buddy. You give all your vengeance voice. And you do the best thing possible. Our hearts face the same thing in today's society. They face the same battles. We bow to idols in our own hearts. Idols which I believe can be identified fairly easy if we simply look at our outcry, if we simply look at our emotions. I'm going to be careful saying this, but even good emotions, even strong, overwhelming, good emotions can identify an idol upon our heart. What is it that I find my greatest achievement in? An overwhelming sense of achievement in this. I did that. I preached till those people's ears fell off. 50 people were saved that day. But I did. I know God gets the credit for it, but I was the one that preached it. And a way, an emotion that I just think I'm overwhelmingly achieved in this particular area. We need to begin to look at our emotions, both good and bad, to begin to determine, are there idols that sit within my own heart? Are there idols which is a good emotion, but it's over the top emotions? And then what about the bad emotions? What about the rage that may well up within me? Is it out of proportion? Oh, we can be angry. That doesn't mean an idol, you know. You come home and your favorite goldfish has been knocked off the shelf, okay? And one of the kids just standing there, I don't know what happened, okay? We can be angry a little bit, okay? Or you can look at it and say, hey, accidents happen, but we can be angry a little bit. I'm not talking about that being an idol in your heart, but if you go nuts about that, I don't care if it is your favorite fish, okay? And you go absolutely crazy off the top, that emotional response at that particular time could be a good indicator of the possibility of some idol that sits upon your heart. And so one of the things that we can begin to look at is within our own lives is to say, is there an idol in my own life that needs to be stroked? And really, I like it. I like, oh, I may not say it. But boy, when I get alone, I'm like, yeah, that was cool. I'm glad they liked me in that one. And then we step back at the same time and say, but it wasn't stroked, was it? Nobody said anything about that message. Nobody liked it. Oh, I'm going to be bad. Tammy is not going to like me for 2 days. We understand. We have this over-the-top emotions to it. Those are all indicators as whether or not we actually have an idol sitting upon our hearts. And what I want to kind of look at here at the very end to bring this to a close is this. In all of this planning, and all of men's choices, Esther, I believe, was laying out a phenomenal strategy here to bring about God's will. But that's exactly what it is, bringing about God's will. In all of our strategies, what I believe that we see here played out in the center of this book, in the book of Esther, is God's sovereignty being played out in the midst of man's responsibility. Now stick with me. When we deal with culture, deal with society, deal with this election coming up in November, when we deal with all of that, we need a sound strategy at times. We need a sound strategy just in our own lives at times. We cannot just let go and let God. Please don't use that statement in my presence. I only have a couple things that I get really animated over. Idol of my heart. Thank you, Lord. But that's one of them. Letting go and letting God. All the way through Scripture, we see responsibilities. You think God's going to walk in and heal you of a particular disease and you refuse to go to the doctor and I'll still eat all the fat that I want to and all the bacon and all that stuff. By the way, I love bacon. Okay, doctor hasn't said I got to watch it yet. Okay. But you think that I'm going to be able to do all of that and still avoid the heart attack that is going to come? God's going to say, no, you don't let go and let God. I'm letting God take care of the fat content in my arteries. No, sorry, doesn't work that way. So this whole idea of letting go and letting God doesn't exist in Scriptures. I know what they mean by it. They mean that once we have understood that we got to give it over to the Lord completely, then we completely rest in His ultimate will and His ultimate outcome that He brings in it. If you're going to say let go and let God there, I'm okay with that. But if it's going to be not working a strategy, that doesn't exist. There's some times within Scripture you need to come out swinging in your plans. Think of Daniel, okay? You think of Daniel. Did he just sit by and do nothing? No, he made a very clear declaration, and we won't do this. We're not going to do this. Made a very clear declaration. He come out swinging about it. But then there's times that the plans need a little more subtlety to them, a little more discretion to be used. There are times in the providence of God that the indirect approach is the best approach. Sometimes the direct approach is not the wisest response. Sometimes subtlety and meekness is more effective in the long run. Those of you who were here for last week's table talks, and we saw downstairs the missionary from Bangladesh, I love that. Not just simply because he had good coffee in it, but it was the whole perspective of missions and how he approached it. His mission field is Bangladesh. Well, what's his platform for it? You know, living like a monk on the back streets and going out in the afternoons and witnessing simply to the people of, you know, the homeless? No. His approach, his platform was a coffee shop. A wonderful coffee shops. You know, at Starbucks. In fact, he was a manager for Starbucks for a while. But he realized that his ability to be able to get into the country that way on a real fine coffee shop and then get into the coffee growers' areas of Bangladesh, which are not opened by the government to anybody for proselytizing purposes. The only purpose that you can get back to the Aborigines, back to the tribal people where the coffee is grown, is for business purposes alone. So what does he do? He teaches them how to grow coffee. He teaches them how to make a living at it. And at the same time, how do you build a church right next to it? How do you give them the gospel with a good cup of coffee at the same time? A subtle approach to God's providential plans in life. Listen to what Peter says in 1 Peter 3:2. Likewise, wives be... I think I gave Paul credit earlier and didn't mean to. 1 Peter 3:1-2. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word, by the conduct of their lives, with their wives, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Wives, don't come in guns blazing with your unsaved husbands, is what he says here. Okay? You're going to church with me and you're going to like it. I'm going to have the car ready at 8. Okay? Most husbands aren't going to want to sign up for that program, folks. And so what does he say? Be subtle about it. Live in meekness and purity and holiness before them. That being said, it wasn't Esther's own subtlety that was able to bring about what ultimately we're going to see in the next couple of weeks here. It wasn't just her subtlety. God used Esther's subtlety, for sure. But he also used Mordecai's stubbornness, didn't he? He also used Mordecai's stubbornness to bow down. Mordecai, you could have bowed down. It's like everybody else, all the other Jews are doing it. But you're just hard-headed, Mordecai. God used the stubbornness of Mordecai. He also used Haman's self-centeredness, didn't he? That's who Haman was. He was self-centered. He loved his ego to be buffed. God used Haman's friends' foolishness and the advice that they had. Never seeking anything deeper, but simply go for it. Everything God used to bring all of these people to the exact place that he wanted them, regardless of her intent, regardless of what Esther's intent was, her invitation to Haman puffed him up, gave voice to his pride, didn't it? That's what it was waiting for. Haman's pride. Who he was looking for that opportunity, and that's what happened. Mordecai's insubordination, not bowing down, just burst Haman's bubble that quickly. The patronage of Haman's friends and his wife led him to build a 75-foot gallows and then request an audience with the king the following morning. You think God is at work in all of this? And do you think God is in the midst of using people with their own willful choices? Absolutely, that's what we see here. All of these events were necessary for the unfolding plan of God. Think about it. If Esther had jumped too early, first time, hey, I walk in and I can give it to her. Do you think chapter 6 is going to happen? By the way, if you don't know the story, you probably shouldn't even read ahead. Mordecai is not going to be able to sleep. And so he's going to call for the books to come, or not. The king is not going to be able to sleep, so he's going to call the books to be read to him. That's always what I want to hear, history books, you know, that'll put me to sleep, okay? But he has a history read to him, and he finds out about Mordecai never being honored for saving his life before. Do you honestly think that that's going to occur if Esther had jumped too early and just simply said, you need to save my people? We're not even going to hear about that. The king's not even going to hear about that. He's either going to make a decision, kill her too, get it over with early, or just rescind the whole thing. But it's not going to come about the way God has intended for it. Nor would the gallows have been constructed. Think about it. Would these gallows already have been constructed if she had jumped the gun and just simply told Mordecai, or the king, what she wanted? It's undoubtedly God's plan for this whole scenario to ride out as it does. But he does it so that the individual conflict between Mordecai and Haman comes to fruition before the greater conflict of the Jewish people comes to its conclusion. That's God's purpose in the midst of it. And he's not violating anything, anybody's will. He's not violating their freedom of choices here. God's plan, in this case, works without miracle in order to save his own people's life. How did he get them out of Egypt? Miracles. How did he save them at the Red Sea? Miracles. How does he save them from all the vipers in the camp? Miracles is how he's done. But we don't see it here. We do not see God using miracles in an amazing demonstration of power from heaven to save his own people. He doesn't do it. But he nevertheless is in the midst of saving his own people. It proceeds with God unobtrusively. I wrote this down and I have it underlined and it's a little lengthy. I want to read it specifically. It proceeds with God unobtrusively nudging each of the characters in the story to behave exactly in accordance with their own wishes and temperaments, while at the same time they do exactly what he has decreed. Nobody exercised anything other than their own desires and their own temperaments with their own free choice, but it all came out exactly as God had decreed before time began. That's a picture of the sovereignty of God and man's responsibility. Every day it plays out around us. Every day it moves forward. God's plans move forward. Not in spite, listen to this, not in spite of our desires and not in spite of my inclinations, that somehow God's going to say, I really got to work this somehow because I know he's not going to want to do this, and I know somebody's going to fly a plane into the World Trade Center and I'm going to have to somehow turn that into good. That's a lie from hell. God is in absolute control of everything that occurs, and he never violates a person's will or his desires or his temperaments, but uses those specifically to bring about his will in all things. That's exactly what we see here. God is in control of all things. He's working all things for us who love him, for our good, and for his glory. We're not passive. We're not passive players in this process. Watch my granddaughters play with their doll houses. Forget what Boo calls her little ones. Tiny little people. I forget what they're called. Boo, I'm sorry. I can't think of what it is. Should have wrote it down. But it's amazing to watch her play with it and within her little house. They're little animals and a little family of animals. Anyways. But to watch her move those around. Oh, it's time to go to bed. Boink. Time to get up and eat. Boom, 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 boom. She sits him down. Mommy's getting dinner. Okay. Hey, time to go out and play. You can say, is that a picture of what God does? Are we simply little dolls in God's dollhouse? No, we are not. We work in accordance with our own wills. We work in accordance with our own desires. We work in accordance with our own temperaments. But God uses those very specifically to bring about exactly what he has preordained since the beginning of time. That's God's sovereignty. The end result will be exactly what God has purposed every time. Just as Esther and Mordecai, Haman and Xerxes were not compelled to act contrary to their will. Do you see anywhere in this scripture that Haman was somehow compelled to act any other way than who he truly was? He was self-centered narcissist. And that's exactly what God used. His decisions as such. And so nowhere do we see this being contrary to our own wills. And still God brings exactly what he has planned about. We are never, ever mere robots in God's plan. God accomplishes his purpose in and through us in the process of shaping us into what he would have for us. Everything that comes into our life, every response that we have is God ordained. He is bringing about what he purposes. Why do you think Paul says this in Philippians? Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence. Listen to this. Work out your own salvation. Don't work out your husband or your wife's salvation. Don't work out your pastor's salvation as you think he should. But you work out, given what God has given you, you work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. What's more, God achieves his perfect goals, not just through our best intentions and our righteous acts, but he actually works through our sins and our compromises. There's hope for Esther. There's hope for us today. Let's pray.